All right, we're in beautiful Sydney, the backdrop of the famous Opera House. And in front of us are Simon Peyton Jones and John Hughes Pascal. Got you guys together. You have very interesting history. So go ahead and introduce yourselves, starting with John.
Okay, well, at the moment I'm at Chalmers University in Sweden, and I'm a professor there. And I also spend half my time at a small company working with testing based on QuickCheck.
Excellent. I'm Simon Peyton Jones. I work at Microsoft's Research Lab in Cambridge. And I've been doing kind of Haskell and functional programming stuff for a long time now, but I've also become a bit involved with computing in education at school recently.
So now, why are we here in Sydney? What's going on?
It's YAO. YAO is a developer conference that we've come to, and YAO has happened in Melbourne. It ran for 2 days, and it happened again in Brisbane. It happened for another 2 days, and now it's here in Sydney.
Yeah.
So we're on a kind of grand tour of Australia. It's very exciting.
Excellent. What do you think of the conference so far?
Oh, it's been very interesting. Great fun.
Good. Now, you guys, and I saw your keynote. Of course, people will be able to see it as well because it was filmed. You mentioned you guys went to college together and sort of you'd known each other for many years.
Right.
So tell us a little bit about that.
So I remember seeing you in the very first mathematics lecture that we ever went to. We studied mathematics together. And I went to the first lecture, and it was a very good lecture, but we were all a bit shell-shocked at the end of it, except Simon. Simon leapt up and rushed down to the front and says, I have a few questions.
I tell you, I was totally shell-shocked, because I remember this lecture very clearly. It was all about, for all delta, there is an epsilon, such that all this stuff about calculus.
Yes.
I've never seen anything like this before. And I looked around the room and everyone was scribbling furiously and looking as if they understood everything. It was complete double dutch to me. So I rushed up to Tom Kerner to try to extract a bit of information from him. Failed utterly, but and spent the rest of the term trying to catch up.
And then I think you came to the Churchill Programmers Union.
That's right, CPU.
That's right, the Computing Society.
Nice.
And Simon turned up, we got to know each other then. And then we started writing a compiler of our own for a language of our own design. But since we couldn't agree on the syntax of any construct, everyone came in two forms, the John form and the Simon form.
Excellent.
It was a great compiler, but in those days we didn't have type systems. So, but we were insisted that every data structure should have pointers to every other data structure. There's no searching or anything. So we had enormous sheets of line printer paper with pencil and paper diagrams with arrows all over the place. This was our type system. We didn't know it at the time, but that's what we were doing.
Excellent. Now, how did you guys land at Haskell?
How did we land at Haskell? Well, we got addicted to functional programming while we were at Cambridge.
Sure.
We were introduced to functional programming by this very eccentric guy, Arthur Norman. And at the time, there was a whole stream of papers coming out about lazy functional programming, things written by David Turner, who was a great inspiration. To me anyway, because he wrote these papers about SK combinators.
Yes.
And there was a stream of papers about called Lambda the Ultimate Go-To and Lambda the Ultimate... It's almost a book of papers by Steele and Sussman. They were very inspirational. So we were all revved up about this functional programming stuff. But it was actually a few years later that we got into Haskell. By the time we'd left Cambridge, I'd been working for a couple of years in a company. You'd got your PhD. And then there were a number of researchers all around the world who were working on lazy functional programming, and we wanted to get together and design a common language.
Excellent. Now, you were telling me, John, some stories about what was Simon like as a young man back in the day when you guys were in class together?
Remember? Young.
Yes.
None of this stuff.
Oh, he was a great character. And also very fond of tea. So I remember we spent a lot of time working together in your rooms in Trinity College, and whenever I would come over, then Simon would get out this vast array of teas and start making Lapsang Souchong or Earl Grey or whatever. So I had only had peachy tits before that, and I learned all about tea from Simon.
As far as I remember, I lived largely on apples and carrots, both of which are very cheap at the Cambridge market.
Right.
I was too mean to pay for Trinity College meals.
Now, there was something also about barefoot.
Oh, that's...
winter.
That's right. Simon was well known for going barefoot at any time of year. Almost, well, you have sandals on now.
Well, that's right. That was pre-sandals. I decided that barefoot was the way to go. But when I left university, I became respectable, so I wear sandals now.
Right.
Now, what about John?
John, I was in awe of John because he was extremely clever. He appeared to understand mathematics in a way that I didn't. But we met often rather late at night in the computer lab, because the Cambridge mainframe was had an accounting system designed by a crazed economist, which meant that it responded very strongly to demand. And at night, the demand was lower, so our credits, our units, would go further, a lot further. So we were there kind of between midnight and 4 a.m. So my memories of John are slightly bleary-eyed somehow.
Yes.
Excellent. So focus a little bit more on Haskell, where we are today. Now, in your talk, you took us from the beginning to 2011.
Right.
So let's start in 2011 and talk about where you think Haskell needs to go to get to 2018.
Okay, can we pass it?
Go.
Well, that's not an easy question.
No.
Okay, one more.
So my dominant idea of Haskell is that it's a kind of laboratory for ideas.
Okay.
Right. So that I see it as a place where interesting ideas about how to design and build programming languages can grow and flourish in a fairly sort of rarefied environment in which they're not distracted with the messy details of the real world. So. And then hopefully ideas from there can transfer into more mainstream languages. So a good example is things that have ideas from Haskell that have ended up in F sharp, like monads turned into workflows in F sharp, and they go further down the pipeline into C sharp. So that's a very productive way, I think. And at the moment, I think Haskell's remained sort of true to a kind of core of a very small functional language in its intermediate language in the middle of the compiler, but he's been growing all the time, especially in the region of type systems. So the two areas that I think that I've been working on mostly recently, one is type systems and one is parallelism, because I think these are two big areas of opportunity where functional languages have a particularly strong role to play.
Yes. So I would agree. I think parallelism is very, very important. Haskell is picking up more and more real users now, and that's very pleasing. But one of the reasons is because it offers a way of getting to grips with parallelism without suffering all of the difficulties that you do in a comparative programming language. So I think that's a big opportunity for Haskell. And I'd hope that it won't just be a source of ideas for other languages, but that it will actually see a lot of real use itself.
Yeah, and it's already seen quite a lot of real use.
It is, yes.
Yeah.
But I think making parallelism work really well is going to be critical to that. So I think that's the most important thing to work on.
And it's difficult, too. And we have been trying to make parallelism work really well in Haskell for some time. And we have lots of leverage and lots of ideas. But actually getting wall clock speed ups for lots of real programs, it's a real challenge. And that's why, fortunately, we're researchers, so we can work on those things. But since I've been here in Australia, I've been talking to lots of people who say, oh, yeah, I do Haskell in my spare time, right, under the radar of my company. And so I've got this new image of Haskell. It's like one of those mushroom fungi that are growing under the ground, and perhaps extending much more broadly than you would see. And maybe one day, not just the ideas, but the actual language will sort of pop up like mushrooms all over the place. There'll be a mass breakout.
Yes.
Have you come across Skriva på?
No.
A new Swedish company using Haskell. They have a very nice business idea that can enable you to sign contracts over the web.
Uh-huh.
And they've built everything with Haskell with very few people. They're extremely happy with it.
So this is exciting. Back in the day, I knew every person who was writing Haskell in the world.
Yes.
And certainly every. Then there was a phase in which I knew every company. And now there's lots of people, companies who are using it I've never heard of, like this one. That's good news.
Interesting. What do you think accounts for the sort of hockey stick growth that you experienced in the last couple of years in terms of usage? Right? The language hasn't got any easier for imperative people to grasp.
Right.
Yet more people are using it.
I think it's the arrival of multicore.
Okay.
So that parallel programming is suddenly important to everybody. And it's difficult. And functional programming is one of the approaches that looks promising. I think that's probably fundamentally why a lot more people are interested in it than used to be.
I think it's also that we're becoming more ambitious in the software that we want to write. So my mental picture of software architecture is that if we want to write big, long-lived software, we're going to want pure type languages, and Haskell is a kind of poster child for that kind of language. I think it just scales better to bigger software. So I think as people have become more ambitious in the software that they write, you know, if you're going to write a 10-line script, it really doesn't matter what language you write it in. Any old thing will do.
Sure.
When you want to write big, long-lived software, any old thing stops doing that. So I think, if you like, I think the whole functional programming research agenda has been a long, slow burn of saying these deep principles are really valuable in the long term, and as time goes on, their importance will become more and more obvious. And the disadvantage, but you do have to rewire your brain a bit to write in a functional programming language, become less and less important.
So I think another factor is that functional features have been appearing in languages like C#, or, you know, Lambda expressions in Visual Basic, and so on.
C++ has lambdas now.
Yeah, so there's lots of good stuff coming into mainstream languages, which is explicitly taken from functional programming ones. And I think then it's natural if people see, oh, look, here's some good stuff that's come from functional programming. Maybe there's more there. Let's see where it came from.
Sure, absolutely. Now, the one of the questions I would have is, if you're, you know, can Haskell scale to... So a silly question was asked. I'm not going to ask that one again. That was at the end of your keynote, which is totally insane. But people can watch that on the video.
You should watch it. Yeah. I was completely taken aback.
So now let's say I wanted to write a general purpose operating system, for example. Could I do that in Haskell? Does it have that degree of modularity and a way for me to organize my code? And
it's being done.
It's been done.
Mark Jones is working on system programming in Haskell.
And Haskell's runtime system is like a mini operating system. Actually, just like the .NET runtime is like a mini operating system. And in some ways, it makes no sense to have a whole platform operating system, and then on top of that, a .NET or Haskell runtime system. It makes quite a lot of sense to just drop that on top of the raw metal.
Sure.
And I guess the Singularity research project at Microsoft Research was another example of doing the same kind of thing.
So somebody's actually doing that with Haskell.
Yeah.
I guess really what my question, what I was trying to get at, was in sheer volume of code and complexity of code, right? Do you have this notion of how to organize a giant Haskell program into modules?
So I think Haskell provides very nice features for structuring programs.
Yeah, so I think it scales fantastically. In fact, one of the things I like about purely functional programming is it sort of forces you to be explicit about inputs and outputs.
Okay.
There's a lot of what an imperative function might do, what a procedure might do, is its effects by modifying state behind the scenes. So I think it aids modularity and it aids maintenance. But if you change what a function does, well, you might have to give it another argument in order to, and that's inconvenient in a way, but it also forces you to find all the call sites, right? If its type signature doesn't change, those call sites can remain unchanged, and the caller doesn't know, that old caller over there doesn't know that it does something new now.
Sure.
See what I mean? So I think it scales actually really well.
So
one thing I think we're still working on is the larger scale modularity. If you've got Haskell packages, sort of units of distribution, and so you want to ship a package that depends on a signature of some other package, this is more in the style of ML modules. So this is a current research project that I'm working on with Derek Dreher. Well, it's led by Derek Dreher and his colleague Scott Kilpatrick.
Excellent.
At MPI. So that's a kind of future direction, really, is larger scale modularity.
So the largest functional program that I'm aware of is not a Haskell program, and it's not a purely functional program, but it's an Erlang program. The control software for Ericsson's ATM switch, which is nowadays it's about 1.5 million lines of Erlang.
Wow.
And you know, it just scaled wonderfully, and they were getting 4 to 10 times better productivity than they were used to. So I think Haskell is the same.
Sure. Now, not to get into the static versus dynamic, because it's not interesting, what's important about such a strongly typed functional programming language in your mind?
So I have a new picture about this, which is that in the early days of type system, we had languages that were strongly typed, but which if you think of, these are the programs that you want to write, they work. These are the programs that are accepted by the type system, and of course there's an overlap. Some working programs are accepted by the type system. Of course there's always going to be programs that don't do the right thing that are accepted by the type system, but the bad thing is the programs that you want to write that are not accepted by the type system. Right? And that's what gives type systems a bad name, because they get in your way. And I think that's what's led to, particularly as you scale up, to the current surge of interest in dynamically typed languages. So for me, then, the name of the game is to try to make type systems more explicit, and so that they can take over more of the territory, more of the programs that you want to write. So there's fewer programs that you would like to write that you can't anymore. And to give you some access, as Eric Meyer puts it, statically typed where possible, dynamically typed where necessary. And I would like to make the dynamically typed where necessary part as small as possible, because I think it gives you such huge benefits for compile time proofs about a lot of bug catching in your program, and maintenance. Maintenance is the big thing that types give you.
Okay.
So I really think that sophisticated type systems, of which Haskell is busy, this is the reason that I think it's important that we work on that in a moment, is really making quite big strides into being more expressive to let you write the programs that you want to write without getting in your way. Still supporting type inference. That's very important because programmers hate writing those types.
So the type system isn't just about rejecting bad programs.
Right.
It's also about overloading and helping you construct your program in the first place. So, for example, Haskell QuickCheck makes very good use of an overloading system. And there's all kinds of very clever work on exploiting overloading to construct the semantics that you want. That's also an important aspect of it.
And it allows you sometimes to express directly in your program the stuff that you would otherwise only be able to express in comments. Like if you got a balanced tree, it's supposed to be a balanced tree. You might write in a comment that just tree is balanced, you know, the left branch is always bigger than the right branch. But how much better if you'd express that in the types and have it checked by the compiler whenever it compiles the program?
Yes.
That's amazing.
Absolutely. Now, since we're sitting in the rain, it's time for an insane question, but I want to talk about the syntax of Haskell, because I think that's what really, there's the conceptual bridge from going from an imperative language like, say, Java or C# into the world of, you know, ML and Haskell. We're talking about Haskell. It is a really big chasm. What's the thinking behind the design of the structure, the syntax level of the language, right? Talk to me about it. I mean, clearly the mathematics and stuff, but that's my question. There is one in there. You guys are nodding your heads, so there's something.
Well, we had a lot of arguments about syntax back in the day, didn't we?
We certainly did.
So what do you think of the syntax? You arrived at this, and now this is what it is. You can't change it.
It's beautiful.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, I think it's the most beautiful programming language. But I also think that we should acknowledge the debt that we owe to David Turner's language designs.
Right.
His Miranda language was also very beautiful. And quite a lot of the syntactic structure of Haskell really comes quite directly from Miranda. Then there are questions like there's only so many ASCII characters, and if you want a one-character thing for one identifier, a two-character thing for something else, you know, prioritizing what you use the characters for is something that we had lots and lots and lots of arguments about. Do you remember the question of whether cons should be one colon or two colons?
Oh, no!
So,
yes. All
at that
too
time,
well.
I remember Phil was very keen to use one colon in type signatures. But that meant, of course, that we couldn't use one colon for cons. We would have to use two colons for cons. So Phil,
just like ML, in fact.
Just like ML. So Phil wrote some example programs to show how nice it would be with two colons. And I noticed that when writing with one colon, one would write X colon X's. It's a pattern match on a list. But with two colons, Phil would write X space colon colon space X's. So the whole thing expanded because the symbol was bigger, the patterns got bigger, it was harder to read them. And I realized after a while that I was looking through his code, but I wasn't actually reading any of the pattern matching. And then that we had a long discussion of that, and in the end we decided that cons was very important and it should have a single character identifier.
Just, we laugh about syntax because we often say, well, it's the, you know, it's not very important, but actually it is really important.
Yes.
It's the user interface of a programming language.
Yes.
And I think you're quite right that we inherited a lot from Miranda and KRC. I think I was probably the single biggest syntactic contributor to Haskell, and it's made a fantastic difference. People often comment how helpful the syntax is or how simple and clean it is. But when you were saying there's a big chasm between Haskell and C#, I don't think it's primarily syntactic. Thinking functionally rather than thinking imperatively is a much bigger conceptual leap.
Sure.
And so much of the habits of mind that you grew up with, if you're a demon, inherit your programmer, suddenly don't apply anymore. And that's quite disconcerting and it's quite a difficult jump to make. I've got great admiration for seriously good Java and C# programmers who make the transition to doing functional programming or can think both ways.
Sure.
Though interestingly, F# is very helpfully sitting in the middle there and helping people transition, right? Because you can do something a bit more gradual. You can write C# programs, but F# encourages you in a gentle way to use a more functional style.
Now, you mentioned Erlang briefly. There's a lot of Erlang discussed at Yao.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a very concurrent language, and you talk about the parallelism problem. It seems, one could argue that just use Erlang to solve the parallelism problem. Why use Haskell?
So Erlang is very, very good in a particular domain. This idea, the domain of scalable services on the internet, solves that problem very, very well. And indeed, that's why you were borrowing ideas
from
it.
That's right. I'm stealing shamelessly.
Yes. Haskell has lazy evaluation. And the strong type system is very valuable. And I think the performance is better. So I think there's lots of reasons for using Haskell.
But I think probably the type system is probably the single biggest one. Yeah. The type system in Haskell is pervasive, and it makes a huge difference about just the way you think about programming.
Yeah. So what's the cost of Haskell?
Well, lazy evaluation does carry an implementation cost, to be sure. But
so I want to write a high-performance application, an image processor. Right now, obviously, you're going to use C or C++ or something like that. Can Haskell do those kinds of things?
So actually, if you think about just pure lazy evaluation and following pointers all the time, then actually, oftentimes, that gets the job done perfectly well enough. We're sometimes obsessed by high-performance applications, but you just want to get a job done, and as long as it's done in a second, it doesn't really matter whether it's a microsecond or a millisecond. So that said, we are beginning to push Haskell into some quite high-performance domains. So the Data Parallel Haskell project and the REPA library, for example, which is a Data Parallel Flat Array library, is getting performance that is kind of in the same ballpark of C. Right? And it does this by doing array-level operations where the arrays contain unboxed values. So here we're giving up on laziness for the array values. Right? At the higher level of the program, we still have lazy evaluation. So one of the things that I guess we're trying to do is to, rather than just stick with purely functional lazy evaluation list processing, try to absorb concurrency with explicit threads and transactional memory, try to absorb Erlang as a library, try to absorb data parallel programming with unboxed arrays and really fast, we're using vector instructions, SIMD instructions. If we can do all of those things kind of in the same language, almost in domain-specific sub-languages, one of the things that Haskell is very good at is allowing a library to appear to be very much like a language. It's called a domain-specific embedded language. And I think we're beginning to find ways of getting really rather good performance for some of these things you might say, just use C. But of course, another good answer is just use C. I mean, where there's a good C library, build a binding to it, and you can use it from Haskell just as if it was native.
Interesting.
So I think Erlang is also relevant here. If you look at Erlang, it runs on a bytecode interpreter, and if you take computational microbenchmarks, the performance will suck. Less so if you look at benchmarks that are very heavy on concurrency, of course, because the Erlang processes are very cheap. But if you look at the performance of systems built with Erlang, then it's often very good. Time and again, a system built with Erlang has won in the market because it outperforms the competition.
Right.
So it's very important not to confuse performance on microbenchmarks with performance on a system. And I suspect that this has to do with the 80-20 rule. The important thing is to find the expensive part of your application and then optimize the hell out of it. And if you use a language in which you can build the first version more quickly and easily, then you've got more time left over for optimization. And that's far more important than the performance of factorial.
Actually, it's not just optimization. Sometimes you know the algorithm and you're just trying to optimize its constant factors. But one of the things you really want to do is to avoid getting obsessed with making your constant factors better and make your asymptotics better. Just use a smarter algorithm. So if you want to explore a kind of design space of smart algorithms, then what you want is a very expressive language that lets you move up. And you may get, an orders of magnitude speed up that way that you could never get if just by improving your constant factors. Look at all the work people do in MATLAB, for example. It has very good, inbuilt array stuff. But the higher level language is very interpreted. It doesn't matter because people are using it to explore the design space. It kind of Haskell's like that. Right? So I think it's really important not to get hung up on just improving constant factors. Go for the algorithm. Build a smarter algorithm.
This is true. So I want to ask this question in this form, right? Clearly, Haskell is the answer. What's the question? That's my new favorite thing to do.
So people have often asked me, what kinds of applications is Haskell particularly suited for? And it's such a hard question to answer because it really is a general purpose programming language. I mean, you can maybe think of some particular applications that it might not be suited for. I don't know, if you want to do matrix inversion, for example, well, maybe that's possible to do fast in Haskell now.
Actually, it is, yeah.
There you are, you see.
Use weather.
It's such a hard question to answer. I think it's really very widely applicable.
Okay.
Let me give you a different kind of answer, though. I think it's Haskell is a language in which it's fun to play. If you read some of the blog posts that people write about Haskell, they're almost whimsical. You know, they do sort of, I don't know, Dan Pipponi does these. He gave this invited talk at ICFP about knot theory expressed in Haskell. So he was writing executable programs that were something I've forgotten how to do with knots, or quantum mechanics or something. So it's somehow it's a language in which people find it possible to express stuff compactly and perspicuously that they just haven't in other languages. So I think of it as a playground, if you like, a lever to sort of open the space of thinking about computation and software in a kind of exciting new way. And you don't know what's going to result from that, right? You just don't know what people are going to invent.
So another answer is domain-specific embedded languages. So if you want to define a domain-specific language, Haskell is really, really good at doing that. That's one of its particular strengths. And implementing a language as a Haskell library makes it very, very easy to modify the language design. You know, if you come up with a new construction, you can just put it into the library, put it into the language, take it out again. You can experiment very, very quickly and easily. And I think that that helps to develop a good domain-specific language.
Right.
Because you can explore possibilities.
You mean before you prematurely committed to a particular design and then implemented a compiler and then, now it becomes hard to change.
Yes, I mean, suppose you write a parser and maybe you write a type checker and so on.
Yeah.
Then by the time you've done that,
you don't want
if you suddenly realise, this design was wrong, I should have taken this construction instead, it's too late.
And also you get all the classic thing about domain-specific embedded languages, you should get all the infrastructure of the host language. Functions and the type system and modules and all of that comes, as it were, for free, and you don't have to re-implement it. So, so then the only question is how nice is the resulting language? And the answer is in Haskell it turns out to be pretty nice.
Yes.
Not quite as perfect as you could do if you crafted it, from a whole cloth from scratch, but pretty good.
The error messages are not as good.
Right on. Well, you guys are soaking wet. Now the rain's coming down.
The rain is really coming down pretty hard now.
Thank you for your time.
It's been great, Charles. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.